What we're going to pick up and talk about this evening is what transpires after the rapture of the church and before the second coming of Christ. What happens, and in this case, not on earth, we'll be dealing with that in the future, but in heaven. And the two major events that are going to occur in that period of time is the wedding banquet or the feast of the Lamb, which we'll be part of, and the event that's going to precede that is the judgment seat of Christ. And we will all be at those two events. This one can be a little bit unnerving when you really look at it from a scriptural point of view, and I don't know if you think about it, but you probably should. First, I want to deal with when is it going to happen. Let's go to 1 Corinthians chapter 4. And in a few moments, we'll come back to this whole chapter 3 and 4 with a lot more intensity, but I just want to go to chapter 4, verse 5 to deal with the timing. In verse 5, Paul writes this. He said, therefore, he said, do not go on passing judgment before the time. He said, but wait until the Lord comes. He said, who will both bring to light the things that are hidden in darkness and disclose the motives of men's hearts, and then each man's praise will come to him from the Lord. And the only phrase I'm interested in at this moment is the phrase, until the Lord comes. And it'll become much clearer as we go on that once the Lord comes, then there's going to be something that happens. Now I want to go to 2 Corinthians chapter 5. We went from 1 Corinthians 4 to 2 Corinthians 5. And in 2 Corinthians 5, again, Paul gets a little more clear, and he says, for we, he's including himself, he's including all of them, and he's including us. For we must all appear before the judgment seat of Christ. No exclusions. We will all appear before the judgment seat of Christ. The word judgment seat is a word that many of you are probably familiar with. It's the word bema. And it's different than how you would view a judge today. It's a little bit more of a, it's a little more casual than that. It's more of a platform. It had three different kinds of uses at the time. And Paul alludes to two of those three uses, even when he talks about it. One way it was used in Acts chapter 18 was when you had a civil dispute with somebody, you would go to the civil magistrate who's in that area, and then he would, in a sense, stand behind the bema, sort of like a table. He would stand behind the bema, and he would render a judgment, sort of like an arbitrator. He would render a judgment if you had a civil dispute with someone. Also, whenever a commanding officer was going to address the troops, he would do so from behind a bema, and more likely it was portable, but he would stand behind it, a place of authority, and then he would address the troops. The other and the most famous way it was used in the early Greek Olympics. And Paul alludes to that. The idea that whenever you would participate in an event, run a race, then if you won the race, you would go to the, well, we would say the judges' stand. They would call it the bema. And when you got to the bema, you would receive a wreath that was placed on top of your head. And that becomes an important aspect of this as well. They would place a wreath on your head. There was nothing probably parallel to that in the ancient world of the Greeks. Because once you got a wreath placed on your head at a bema stand, you became a local, when you went back to your city, state, or wherever you went, hero. And some of the things they write about it are you were given tax-free for the rest of your life. You were given, you know, the keys to the city, so to speak. You were given income. You were given a home. So they were very competitive in a way that very much like we are, but you got all that because you got the wreath, because you got it at the Bema. And so he says here, he said, for we must all appear before the judgment seat, the Bema of Christ. And then he gets very particular, that each one. And so I don't think this is one of those you can hide in the crowd things. You know, like we're all going to be there and he's going to talk to all of us and it's going to be great. I don't think it's like that. I think you're going to be right in front of him, just you and him. That has to be an astounding thought. Each one, notice, may be recompensed. And that's a positive affirmation. We'll talk about that as it goes on. For his deeds. And that's the word ergon. That is almost always means a positive work. For his works or for his deeds. You will be given a recompense for your deeds. He says, in the body, which means while you are alive, you will, and it's from Christ, gain a recompense for the deeds you did while you were alive, according to what he has done. And then he says this, and this is kind of scary, whether good or bad. Uh-oh. And that creates kind of a problem. And the reason it creates a problem is we really don't understand what the word bad means. Our natural inference here when we see the word bad is, uh-oh, he's going to deal with my sins. He's going to deal with my evil. That would be double jeopardy. Okay? That's not what it means at all. Sin was taken care of on the cross. It is finished. You see that part? It's not what he's talking about. This word for bad is a word, phallos. P-H-A-U-L-O-S, phallos, and it means worthless. See, worthless. It's not a moral, evil, bad. Oh, he's a bad actor. You know, no, it's not that. It's worthless, either good or worthless. And he'll explain this in much more detail when we go back to 1 Corinthians. So he said, each one of us, the participants, the judgment seat is when he comes back, the judgment seat is the place where Christ will do it. The beam and the participants are all of us. And the purpose here has nothing to do with heaven or hell. That's called the great white throne judgment. That's a very different kind of judgment. Only the unsaved will be at that particular judgment. This is a judgment restricted basically, in a sense, very much for the church preparing itself. I think I talked the last time a wee little bit about the wedding and how the stages were of the wedding. Did I do that in this? Okay. Remember that the bride has got to be dressed out, right? And how is she dressed out? In the righteous acts of the saints. In other words, she's dressed out in her pure acts. That's what happens at the Bema. At the Bema, we're sort of given a makeover. We're sort of cleaned up as we become the bride and become in that ceremonially one with Christ. Let's go now to Romans chapter 14. Romans chapter 14. And something that's kind of interesting about the judgment seat of Christ is it's an extremely important thing. But whenever Paul talks about it, he doesn't, how do I say this, purposefully talk about it. He's not like he's trying to say, no, look, there's a lot of things. Paul has an agenda. He has a theological agenda. He wants you to know and believe certain things, and it's absolutely true that you do. In these cases, both in the Romans and the Corinthian case, when he talks about the Bema, it's sort of incidental. In other words, Paul is talking about something else. And then because he is sort of rebuking the church in Rome and rebuking the church in Corinth about something else, he brings in the idea of the judgment seat. And the problem that they're having is judging people. And so he alludes to that. In Romans 14, for example, in verse 10, he says this. He said, but you, why do you judge your brother? You see, who are you to judge? Or you again, why do you regard your brother with contempt? He said, for we shall all stand before the judgment seat of God. And this time he says the judgment seat of God. The other in Corinthians, he said judgment seat of Christ. That draws the equality between God and Christ, both of them the capacity to judge. He said, as it is written, as I live, says the Lord, every knee will bow to me, every tongue shall, he says, give praise to God. So then each one of us shall give an account of himself to God. Wow, that's all of us again. So you're going to give an account to the Lord at the judgment seat. If it's not intimidating enough. I mean, have you ever thought about that? That you're going to stand before him, just you? He's going to talk to you? And really, the hard part is you're an open book to him. So all the ways in which you justify yourself now, you won't be able to justify yourself then. I don't even think you'd want to try. Now, let's look at it in more detail. Let's go back where we started in 1 Corinthians 3. In 1 Corinthians 3, in verse 1, you're going to get the context of why this is happening. Why did he bring it up? He says, and I, brethren, could not speak to you as spiritual men, but as to men of flesh, as to babes in Christ. For the sake of sounding and intentionally sounding redundant, let me explain it again. There is nothing in this letter that the Corinthians do right. If a church can believe the wrong thing and act the wrong way, they did it. This church is by miles the worst possible church in the New Testament. And they have all kinds of issues. At the source of almost all their issues is their Greek pride. And it taints everything. They see themselves first as Greeks and then as Christians. Americans can face the same kind of thing. See ourselves first as an American, second as a Christian, and it causes us a lot of problems. Now notice what he said to them. I gave you milk to drink, not solid food, for you were not yet able to receive it. Indeed, even now you're not yet able. You should be by now, but you can't. He said, for you are still fleshly, or the carnal. You are still fleshly, for since there is jealousy and strife among you, are you not fleshly, and are you not walking like mere men? Now, the context is going to come up in verse 4. Understand something about the Greeks and their pride. The Greeks see themselves as intellectuals. They know that they're probably, at least in Western civilization, the greatest thinkers of all time up to their time. They have the history. They don't view the Romans, by the way, as intellectually superior at all. They would view the Romans as intellectually weaker. But militarily superior. The Greeks have a unique way. And the Greeks are sort of just like we are. The Greeks' history is to follow men. In other words, if I was going to oversimplify it, if you were going to break down the Greek culture and say, who are you? Who shapes your thinking? They would basically say it's either going to be Plato or his student Aristotle. And Plato and Aristotle are very different, extremely different in how they see life. Even though Aristotle was, you know, a student of Plato, you would think they would be, but they're not. Plato is metaphysical, a bit mystical. He's abstract. He believes that there is a spiritual reality that is the true reality, and everything that you see physically is sort of a shadow of the real reality, which is spiritual. He's not too far off when you think about this, and he's doing this hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years before Christ came. He's got this kind of thought through. Aristotle was known for his Aristotelian logic. Aristotle is more of a nuts and bolts guy. It's more what is logical. How he's much more of a materialist. Greeks would always see themselves that way. Now, there were tons of others. I mean, even before Socrates, there was Anaximander and Anaximenes and Thales, the pre-Socratic philosophers. They all influenced the Greeks. But the Greeks loved that. You lock onto a man, and then that man shapes your philosophy. So these are Greek Christians. So notice what happens in verse 4. when someone says, I am of Paul, and another says, I am of Apollos, now you can see what they're doing already. They're already, in a sense, they do it with Peter. The whole idea for them is, that's who I am. And by the way, don't look smug, you people, the same way, you know. You hear that kind of thing all the time, you know. What Charles Stanley says, you know, I'm a MacArthurite. Be careful, you know. I know if you mean the right thing, there's no problem with it. But if you mean it more than you should, there's a big problem with it. How many celebrities are there in the universe? Just one. Okay, that's Paul's point. You see, that's his point. He said, I'm of Paul, or another said, I'm of Apollos. Now understand, Paul set the foundational work there. He planted the church there. He led them to Christ. He got them going. And then he brought in basically his slickest guy. Of all the people in the Pauline team, the most eloquent, without question, is Apollos. Apollos probably would know the Old Testament as well or even better than Paul. But there's a difference between Apollos and Paul. Paul says, I'm not really a really good public speaker. Apollos is all that. He's really smooth. You see, oratory is his thing. That's why Paul sent him to the Corinthians, because they love that. You see, so he sent Apollos. By the way, they didn't like Apollos much in the end. Anyway, he sent Timothy. They threw Timothy out. Not a good group of folks. But the point is Paul then says, he says, and what is Paul? What is Apollos? What are we? And he, in the New American Standard, it says servants. That we like that word in English. The Greek word is not as nearly as gentle. It's the word doulos, they're slaves. Paul uses that all the time. I'm a slave of Christ. Not a servant. I'm a slave. You see, there's a difference. When you say slave, that's one thing. When you say servant, that's another. You see, the slave, like, oh, so you say slave, you don't have a choice. Paul said, yeah, that's right. I don't have a choice. I'm a slave of Jesus Christ. So we don't like that word so much, so we'll use the word servant. He said, we are servants through whom you believed, even as the Lord gave opportunity to each. Or even as the Lord gave to each one. He said, look, even when you got saved, I didn't want to tell you this, but I think you know this, I didn't save you. You see, the words I spoke came from the Lord, and the conviction you felt came from His Spirit. So it's a God thing. You know, it's not a me. So He said, I planted and Apollos watered. Now, notice the metaphor there. He loves to change metaphors. The metaphor there is gardening. It got it from the Lord, the parable of the sower. He said, I planted, Apollos watered, but God was causing the growth. He says, so then neither the one who plants nor the one who waters is anything. Please stop this. You see, please. He said, but God causes the growth. Now, he who plants and he who waters are one. Apollos and I are one. We're close. But each will receive his own reward according to his own labor. The first inference, Apollos will stand before the judgment seat of Christ. I will stand before the judgment seat of Christ. He said, for we are God's fellow workers, and you are God's field. He says, and let me use another metaphor. You're God's building. So he changes metaphors and he uses both of them. You're the field, you're the building. And then he says, according to the grace, the charis, you could say the gift or the enabling grace, according to the enabling grace of God, which was given to me as a wise master builder, I laid a foundation and another is building upon it. Now he says, but let each man be careful how he builds upon it. So Paul says, look, I'm a foundational guy. I came in first. I gave the gospel. I got you started. We got a church going. Let's go. Apollos comes in. His job is to take it to the next step. Talk to him maybe a little bit more about who Christ is, what the Christian life is like, et cetera, et cetera. Now, he moves to the idea of building because he understands that the Greeks, of what makes a building great to them. So he says this. He says, now, if any man builds upon the foundation with gold and silver and precious stones, and then he says something odd, wood, hay, and straw. Now, to the Greeks, and this is a lot like this in the ancient world, but to the Greeks, the idea that you built the building is good. Needs a good foundation, needs to look nice. But if you're going to build something like the temple of Diana, you know, you're going to build her a temple, then that baby, once you walk inside it, that baby better be loaded with gold and silver and precious stones. In other words, that gives it the wow factor. You see, look at that. You see, think of the Jewish temple. What was it like in the inside? You see, very different. But see, on the inside, the idea, gold, silver, precious stones. So the idea is, if you do it right, you put in all this wow factor. But just imagine when you completed the building and said, all right, guys, now let's really make it something. Get as much mud and straw as you can, and we'll just plaster mud and straw over all of it, especially on the inside. We'll plaster it everywhere. How would that look? You see, it wouldn't look good at all. And that's his point. He's using a metaphor, but he's making his point. Now he says, each man's work will become evident, for the day will show it. The day that we stand before Christ, your work will become evident. Your work is going to be gold, silver, precious stones, or it's going to be wood, hay, and straw. It's going to be one or the other. And he says, because it is to be revealed with fire. Now, that always goes back to, from Leviticus on, the judgment of God is almost always, the metaphor for it is always fire, and it always has to do with his all-consuming holiness. And so the idea is God's holiness just consumes. And if it's not holy and it won't stand up, it's consumed completely. If it is holy, if it is gold or silver, precious stones, all the fire does is refine it. It makes it even better. So that's why he likes and uses that particular metaphor. And he said, that's what will happen. The day will reveal it. He says, and the fire itself will test the quality of each man's work. Not quantity, but the quality of each man's work. Now, if any man's work, which he has built upon it, remains, he said, he's going to receive a reward. In other words, when the fire hits the wood and straw, you see, what happens? It's consumed, it's gone. But when it hits the gold, silver, precious stones, it's refined, it stays. And he says, you'll receive a reward. That's pretty neat. If any man's work is burned up, wood, hay, straw, he said, he shall suffer loss. But he wants to be careful, they don't misunderstand. But he himself will be saved yet as through fire. This is not about your salvation. This is not about whether you'll be in heaven. This is not about that at all. He is just talking about what you've done to serve him since you've become a believer. Now, what's interesting about that is some guys really love to get on the idea that he shall suffer loss. And I think way too far. I've heard sermons and even read in books what a lot of teachers will say is that when you stand before the judgment seat, for a lot of you, what you're going to feel is enormous shame. You're going to be so ashamed of the way you lived. I don't really see that. I think that's not really what he's doing. Remember, I am, remember what he said that, and that happens in the rapture? The moment we are changed, the perishable shall put on the imperishable. You know, the whole idea is, and I'm conformed to the image of Christ. You see, that whole idea, the Bema is not about a shame on you kind of judgment. The Bema is about rewarding you. You see, the Bema is about the reward he has for you. That's what it's about. It's not about the idea of saying to you, you know, boy, you know, you ought to be ashamed of yourself. I don't even know what I'd feel if I had the character of Jesus Christ. You see, to make that something more than it is, I think it simply seems I lose what is that reward. And as this goes on, I think you're going to get what I'm saying at the end and go, wow, that's better than I thought it was going to be.
So, when you finally realize what you were doing was not right, and not right, that becomes, now you're becoming more, and you're transfigured, you're becoming more like Christ. It's when you realize it right there that you're telling
me. Yeah, except it's not going to be that. It's not what you do. Yeah, but it's not what you do. That's If you beg off just a little bit, we'll cover that. And when we cover it, I think you'll see that, wow, I get it now. So he says, do you not know? And now immediately he says to him, look, you're to be holy, set apart by God. Now, I don't know if you get that, he said, because of the way you are. You're so carnal. You're so fleshy. You live just like unbelievers. He said, do you not know that you are the temple of God and that the Spirit of God dwells in you? He said, if any man destroys the temple of God, God will destroy him, for the temple of God is holy. That's what you are. That's your position. You're holy people. Now, he's told that. Now, think of this. In one chapter, Paul was told, and this is the dilemma of Christianity, Paul was told the Corinthians, you're fleshly. You're a babe in Christ, and you lack just like unbelievers. You're holy, and you're perfect in God's eyes. That's Christianity. You see, that's my position in Christ, and that's my experience in life. I can be both of these things. See, the dichotomy here is true. Both things can happen. It's not either or. He said, let no man deceive himself. If any man among you thinks that he is wise in this age, what do the Corinthians think? No one's wiser than we are. We're Greeks. We got wisdom. He said, if any man among you thinks that he's wise in this age, let him become foolish that he may become wise. He said, for the wisdom of this world is foolishness before God. For it is written, he is the one, he said, who catches the wise men in their craftiness. And again, the Lord knows the reasoning of the wise, that they are useless. You see, don't think your wisdom is going to impress God. It won't at all. He said, so then let no one boast in men. Please, don't tell me how smart Plato was. When you tell Jesus that, he won't be impressed. See, it's that idea. Don't boast in men. He said, for all things belong to you. There's the joint heirship idea. This is amazing, but Paul always reminds me of the kind of guy that, you know, he gives you a hug and then a shot, and then he gives you a hug and then gives you a shot, you know. And he can do it, and he does it simultaneously. He's just good at it. He said, whether Paul or Apollos or Cephas, he said, or the world or life or death or things present or things to come, all things belong to you. And you know what? You belong to Christ, and Christ belongs to God. Got to stop this. Your whole line of reasoning is wrong. Now, he goes on. He said, let a man regard us in this manner. If you want to have regard for me, here I am. I'm a slave of Christ. Now, remember something. The Greeks, the free Greeks, look over. That's why Paul chooses the word. That's why it should never be translated servants. How do you think an aristocratic Greek looks at slaves? Non-human property. By the way, there are slaves and aristocratic Greeks in this church. So guess what the aristocratic Greeks do? Several chapters from now. When it comes to the Lord's table, they make sure the slaves work till they're late, and then they come and they eat all the food and drink all the wine at the Lord's table, and then when the slaves come, there isn't any for them. Because they don't want to have fellowship with them anyway. So Paul said, wow, that's why some of you are sick and some of you are dead. You can't, you see, you're blaspheming the Lord's table. The whole point of it is your relationship with others. So Paul, I think, uses the term slave, and I'm certain they wouldn't like it. He said, but that's I am. I'm a slave of the mysteries. He said, I'm a slave of Christ. He said, I'm a steward of the mysteries of God. In this case, moreover, it's required of stewards that I be found trustworthy. God has given me a job. I am a special kind of slave in one way to God. I'm a steward. And the steward servant is the servant that takes care of the affairs of the household. He said, that's my job, and I do it. I'm trustworthy. He said, but to me, and I love this, it's a very small thing that I should be examined by you. I love that. You know what he's saying? I really don't care what you think of me at all. He said, or by any human court. In fact, I do not even examine myself. You see, it doesn't matter what you think of me, and it doesn't matter what a court would think of me. It doesn't matter what I think of me. What's he getting to? It only matters what the Lord thinks of me. I've said this before, but I can remember many years ago, I went to First Baptist New Orleans when I was on St. Charles Avenue for a pastor's conference with John MacArthur in town. And there was a lot of guys there who have really struggling and hurting in ministries. And were really being abused and by their churches, and a lot of angst in the room. And so when it got the question and answers, they asked John, how do you, you know, deal with a board of people that don't like you, a committee in the church, or Southern Baptist committee in the church that doesn't like you? And John said, well, I don't deal with that at all. No, I mean, he goes, oh, you misunderstand. I don't care what they think, any of them. And I mean, it was just like, what? No, so I don't. He said, I don't care what Christ thinks. That's it. And he said, and the job description I have, man can't write that for me. How presumptuous. Christ has told me what to do. Preach the word, he said, and model it. That's my job description. That's all I do. That's my job. And it was stunning to them. They never even could have imagined something like that. And by the way, even when we went out to John MacArthur's church, you know, leadership years ago, a pastor couldn't be more beloved by his people. I mean, they just love him. But the point is, he goes, I can't do that. It doesn't matter. And that's what Paul is saying. Look, if you guys don't like me, I'm okay with that. You see, it doesn't matter what you think. You know, if you think I'm good or bad, it doesn't really matter. And he said, look, he even says, I do not even examine myself. Now watch, I am conscious of nothing against myself. Yet I am not by this acquitted. The one who examines me is the Lord. See, when I stand before the judgment seat of Christ, I'll get a real good idea of whether I was really a servant of Christ or not. And, you know, if I can say, well, I can produce a whole group of people that think I was Mr. Wonderful, it won't help me. See, there's no help there. It's only him. Now, back to where your question goes. He says, therefore, do not go on passing judgment before the time. He says, but wait until the Lord comes, who will both bring to light the things hidden in the darkness, and then the key, and disclose the motives of men's hearts. He said, and then each man's praise will come to him from God. Now we sort of come full circle. Remember, we talked about the deeds or the works of the ergon. But at the judgment seat of Christ, he's not going to talk about what you did. Yeah. He's going to talk about why you did it. Why did you do that? What was your motive? It's a very different thing. You see, and without question, you know this to be true. A lot of what you do is your motives are selfish. You want people to see it. You want people to approve of you. You want people to say, attaboy, attagirl, wow, that's impressive. Wow, you're really something. Oh, no, no, no. Oh, no, no. You see, that's kind of what we do. That's kind of what we knew. You see, that can be extremely disarming. When I first became a Christian, within a very short time, I began teaching. And then within another short time, I'm only in my early mid-20s, and then I started preaching. And I think it was preaching. I'm not even sure what I was doing. But I was up there, and I was in a bunch of different churches and denominations and all that. Well, it was amazing because, really, I think probably for the only thing I could ever compare to it or how good it made me feel was I had been coaching Little League and peewee football and stuff like that before, so I loved doing that because I loved the kids, but I also loved the idea that the parents loved me doing it and that the parents loved me and the kids loved me, and I thought, wow, I'm a lovable guy, you know, and that makes you feel good. So when I started that, I can remember thinking, you know, wow, I really like the way this feels. This really feels good. You know, wow, this is really something. And then I ran into this. And from that moment on, for years and years, it bothered me. You see, because I kept thinking, even when I teach the word, am I looking for a little approbation? You see, do I want to be approved of? You see, approbation lust is sinful. I want to be approved of. I want to be approved of. You see, we do that. I want people to say good things about me. You see, wow. So I can still remember the moment, not exactly, but the year, but the moment. We were at a men's retreat over on the Mississippi Gulf Coast, and Keith Boyer, who was a Grace Seminary grad, who was a Christian counselor here and went to our church, and then went over to Faith Bible Church in Slidell to pastor, and now Keith's in Pennsylvania pastoring. But Keith and I were talking a lot about this, and Dr. Earl Rodmacher was the speaker at the conference. He was the president of Western Seminary out of Portland, Dallas Seminary grad, very, very outstanding man. And so we made an appointment with him after, I think, the Friday evening session that he would talk to us. So we went to a little room and talked, and we said, Dr. Rodmacher, we struggle with this. And is it because, like, we're carnal and fleshly? But we really struggle with this because we had this idea that in our mind that whenever you did something for the Lord, either you did it for a selfish, fleshly motive or you did it strictly for the Lord. And what ended up happening was it was hard to see yourself through that. Which one is it? I don't know. And we said, how do you handle it? You know, because we have no peace about it type of thing. And Dr. Rodmacher said, oh, I don't have any problem with that at all. I thought, well, yeah, because you're a godly man, and we're not, and so you do everything. And he said, no. He said, the reason I don't have any trouble with that is I think you misunderstand it. Don't underestimate the Lord. He said, I believe almost everything that I would do because I'm in this fleshy body has a mixed motive. Some of it is for the Lord's glory and because I love him so much. And some of it's for me. He said, the Lord discerns which it is. He said, it's gold, silver, precious stones, the stuff that's for him. And he said, and the stuff that's for me is wood, hay, and straw. And that was freeing to me. That was really, really freeing to me to hear that. Because he's going to be able to discern what part is what. Now, as you grow as a Christian, you see, if it was 80% you and 20% him when I first started in my 20s, I'm hoping now it's at least 80% him and 20% me as you grow. And I think it is. And I can use the analogy, and I can tell you why. The reason why is I have fallen so much deeper in love with him. And that's why. Now, I'll give you an analogy to make it work. Have you ever been and been needed, in a sense, to care for someone, a child, sibling, spouse, parent, who is deathly ill? You see, I mean really, really ill. And I'll start with an easier analogy. As a mother or father, but especially a mother, did you ever spend most of the night up with a really sick child? Now, I want to ask you something. Did you think in your mind, I can't wait until my sister-in-law calls tomorrow and I tell her what a great mom I am because I was up all night? Would you be motivated like that? Not at all, would you? Why? You love the child. You see, you love the child. See, your love, the motive here is pure. This child has a need. I'm this child's mom. I'm this child's dad. And I'm going to meet that need. You see, that's purely motivated. And that's service. And I think that's what happens as you grow in the grace and knowledge of Christ and as you grow in your love for Christ. Then out of that love for him, it becomes clearer and clearer. When you can see it in Paul's words. Let me be as clear as I can, he said. I am nothing. He's everything. See, then that's Paul. And then, by the way, when Paul talked about himself, what did he say? I am the chief of sinners. You want to know who I am? I'm the chief of sinners. See, whenever Paul talked about himself, he always talked about his weaknesses. But whenever he talked about his strengths, he always talked about the Lord. Because he was a mature believer. So what ends up happening in this case is a matter of your motives. Now, by the way, this plays right off of what Jesus Christ teaches. So I want to go now to the Sermon on the Mount, Matthew chapter 6. Matthew chapter 6. Jesus warns about this. He says in verse 1, beware. Of what? Of practicing your righteousness before men to be noticed by them. What does that speak directly to? Your motive. That's your motive. You see, your motive is, I practice, and he's talking about righteousness here. He's not about sinning. He's talking about your righteousness, the best you can be. Beware, he said, of practicing your righteousness. the best you have to offer before men so that men will see it. So you'll impress people. He says, you got to be careful with this. He then says, he said, otherwise, now watch, you have no reward with your Father who's in heaven. Now he wants to illustrate it. When therefore you give alms, do not sound the trumpet before you, as the hypocrites do in the synagogues and in the streets, that they may be honored by men. Now the whole idea is, now he's back to something like giving. Why does he use that? Oh, what a temptation that is. You want to give, and especially if you want to give in a large way or a sacrificial way. Golly, don't you just want somebody to know? You do. You see, you do. Jesus, that's hypocrisy. You see, that's the way. And by the way, when you think about this, just think of how terrible in the past that churches have been with this. You know, we're going to put 60 new pews in here. And if your family will give $2,800 each, you'll get a plaque with you, the family name on the pew. It's just selling indulgences. I mean, it's the same idea, but it's the idea. So what's your motive? You see, what's your motive here? I mean, over the years, people have come on occasion and said, you know, I have a very, you know, significant gift that I want to give to the Lord, to you first, Pastor. Really? Now, inevitably, if it's just a check, I would fold it and put it in my pocket. Most of the people over there kind of swore not to tell me what comes in anyway or who gives anything. I don't really care. But the point is, I've actually said to one fellow, I said, well, if I look at this, I'll probably say, wow, thank you. And that will probably be your reward. But if that's what you want, you can have it. You see how that works? Because what's a tendency here? See, he knows what our heart is. You see, he knows how this works. And by the way, you could give and it could still be the institution in which you give. You could give with the right motive and the institution could still give you in a sense. I can remember when I was at the seminary, they built a new library, tremendous library, wonderful library, great for the students. And it's called the Turpin Library. And that's because the Turpin family gave $15 million or something and built the library. So it's called the Turpin Library because they gave the money. Now, if their intention was that everyone knows we're given the $15 million for the library, and because we want them to say, well, thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you, you're so wonderful, you're so wonderful. What I think Jesus is saying is that's their reward. But by the way, put yourself in their shoes. What if you were going to get $15 million? Would you want somebody... You see? Would you want to give a cashier's check anonymously of $15 million to an institution? Jesus would say you probably should. But what about in our hearts? Is that the way we operate? You see, this is a temptation on our part. Notice what he says then. He says, but when you give alms, do not let your left hand know what your right hand is doing, that your alms may be in secret, and your Father who sees in secret, he'll repay you. What's he repaying for me? What's important to God? How much I gave or what's my motive? See, that's why we don't have Stewardship Sundays and never will, at least as long as I'm standing. And the reason for it is simple. If your motive's not pure, please keep it for yourself. Please don't. You know, you're supposed to give not grudgingly, not of necessity. And to hear someone constantly ring a bell and tell you to try to get you through guilt or competition or something to give is ludicrous to me. See, the whole point of it is just doing it. That's one thing I love about offering boxes. You don't even get a chance to, you know, sort of drop your check in from, you know, into a plate that goes by. You don't even get a chance to do it. You just walk in and do it. And if you don't do it, no one cares and you're on your way. But that's because in those areas, we have to be careful. Because our motives can easily go wrong. Now watch. It's not just there, though. Verse 5. He says, and when you pray, he says, you are not to be as the hypocrites. They love to stand and pray in the synagogues and on the street corners in order to be seen by men. He said, truly I say to you, they have their reward in full. Now, we don't do that. We don't stand on street corners and do that too much. But let's be honest. Prayer is your conversation with God. It's probably very good to just be honest with God and when you converse with God. How many of you have been ever in a small group of some sort, and you now realize that there's six of you or whatever, and they've just said, we're all going to pray? So, Ralph, you start, okay? Now, you're number four. By the time number two is praying, what are you doing? I want to sound like I'm somebody when it comes to me. You see, I really want to, you know. Oh, magnificent eternal Father, who rides a chariot of love across the heavens. We come before you this evening. What are you doing? See, what are you doing? Are you praying to be heard by men? Or are you praying to God? And remember, God knows your thoughts. I've said this years ago, but I've said it many times, but years ago we were in Lakeview, and I don't remember his name, I'll call him John, but there was a fellow who attended a small group in Lakeview, and he was a motorcycle, he was a biker, and he got himself in a really bad accident. I mean, the kind where you have, you know, the stitches and, you know, the arm. I mean, he was in pretty bad shape, and he was sitting there, and everyone was praying at the end of the small group, because that's what you do. You have time of prayer, you know. And everyone's praying, and he asked if he could pray. And surely you can pray. And it was just like this. His name was John. He said, God, this is John. Thanks for not killing me. I thought that might have been the best prayer I heard in a small group in a long, long time. He wasn't trying to impress us. He wasn't trying to run through. He was just trying to tell God how he felt. You see, Jesus says, be really careful when you pray. See, if you're praying to be heard by men, that's a different thing. One last one. He then goes to, he goes on in verse 16 and says this. He says, and whenever you fast, he says, do not put on a gloomy face as the hypocrites do. For they neglect their appearance in order to be seen fasting by men. Truly I say to you, they have their reward in full. So you go to something as intense as something in your life, and you go to fasting. You see, Jesus says, I love this, but when you fast, how about anointing your head? He said, wash your face so that you may not be seen fasting by men. He said, how about when you fast, you look the best you can look? You see, we'd want to say, well, you know, boy, you look really rough. Yeah, I'm going through a tough time. I'm fasting. Well, you know, when you tell me that or someone that, that's it. Now, by the way, tell someone else because they'll say, wow. And you'll get that. You'll get the wow. If you tell me that, I'd say, wow, that was really bad. You shouldn't have told me. See, what are you telling me for? I just wanted you to know how godly I am. See, you can't do that. You see, when you're fasting, someone come up and say, what? You look great. See the temptation? Yeah, but I'm fasting. You almost still want to say it, you know, because you want the approval. He said, so that you may not be seen fasting by men, but your Father is in secret. Your Father will see in secret, and he will repay you. You see, this is the whole point. That's why the motivation thing is so important. We have a couple propensities. We have a propensity to sin and do evil. We have a propensity to religion. We have a propensity to do good. What is called human good. In other words, do human beings that don't know Jesus do good things? Absolutely. That's called human good. But they do it for themselves, or they do it for humanity. We're to do good things, but only for the glory of God. See, that's why we do good things. That's why Isaiah said, a man's righteousness, that's the best a man can be, a man's goodness, a man's righteousness is as of filthy rags to God. And filthy rags, as you've heard in the past, is used menstrual cloths. I don't know if you get a clear picture than that. In other words, the idea is God says, look, human good doesn't impress me. Man is to do human good for my glory, not for his. You see, and that becomes an issue to us. So, we get rewarded by the Lord. Now, I want to take this one more step now and look at a couple things. Go with me to 2 Timothy 4. And I want to talk a little bit about crowns. 2 Timothy 4. Paul's last words. In 2 Timothy 4, in verse 6, Paul says, I am being poured out as a drink offering. The time of my departure has come. I have fought the good fight. I have finished the course. I've kept the faith. In the future, he says, there is laid up for me the crown of righteousness, which the Lord, the righteous judge, will award to me on that day. And not only to me, but also to all who have loved his appearing. Ah, you see, all who loved his appearing, that's a crown that we can all get. You see, do you love the idea of the appearing of the Lord, the second coming of the Lord? He says, he gives a crown for that. I believe these four or five examples in the New Testament of crowns are not the only crowns. I believe they're just examples of crowns, not all the crowns. I think the rewards are probably very, very numerous. Now, I want to look at this one. This is an important one. Let's go to James 1. Just two books to your right, James 1. Now, you know the tough verses in the beginning, especially if you're going through a tough time in your life. He says, consider it all joy, my brethren, when you encounter various trials, knowing that the testing of your faith produces endurance. Let endurance have its perfect result, that you may be complete or perfect, mature, lacking in nothing. So he talks about that. But notice verse 12 then. He said, happy is the man or woman. Blessed is a man who perseveres under trial. He says, for once he has been approved, he will receive the crown of life, which the Lord has promised to those who love him. Is there a reward for people who persevere and stay faithful through really difficult things in their life? Yes. Why wouldn't Christ notice that? You know, so if you've been, you know, deserted, if you've been handicapped, if you go through tremendous physical suffering, whatever it is, the Lord notices all that. You know, there's a crown for that. He says, the way you persevere means a great deal to me. Turn to 1 Peter, just another book to write, 1 Peter chapter 5. Now he's talking to leadership in the context of the church. And he says, therefore, I exhort the elders among you as your fellow elder and witness to the sufferings of Christ and a partaker also of the glory that is to be revealed. What I want you to do, he said, is shepherd the flock of God among you, exercising oversight. But don't do it under compulsion. Do it voluntarily, according to the will of God. Do not do it for sordid gain, but with eagerness. He says, nor yet as lording it over those allotted to your charge. Don't use it as authority. You see, don't lord it over people. Boy, I think pastors should have magnets on their refrigerators with this, because a lot of them lord it over everybody. And he says, but proving to be examples to the flock. And when the chief shepherd appears, he will receive the unfading crown of glory. Another crown. I don't believe that these are only examples. I mean, I believe they're only examples. I don't believe this is all there is. I think what he does is he basically says, I reward. Now, there's a problem in my head, and maybe it's in yours. And that is, well, then what do you mean? For eternity in heaven? You see how this is going to work? I mean, what's this going to be like? You see, I come out of my dwelling place. In my Father's house are many dwelling places. All right? So I come out. It wasn't a good day for me at the judgment seat. You know, I have a beanie, you know. That's what I got. Jack lives next door to me forever. I pray not, but Jack lives next door to me forever, and he's got a crown. He comes out every day. Hey, morning. There's something wrong with that thought in heaven, isn't there? The whole idea forever, I got to look at that stupid crown. You know, look what I did. I mean, it doesn't even seem like it'd be heaven, because it's not. That's not the way it works. Last passage I want to look at. Revelation chapter 4. Now remember, when we're dealing with prophecy, we talked about Revelation chapter 2 and chapter 3, his letters to the churches. And then chapter 4, I said it changes. Starts moving in a direction. And boy, as it changes and moves, it goes into all the judgments that are coming. But the first scene you see in chapter 4 is heaven. John goes from heaven to earth to heaven to earth the whole way through the book. And when heaven, in chapter 4, you have this incredible scene of worship. It's astounding, the worship that's going on. You see all kinds of things happening. He says in chapter 4, verse 1, he says, "And these things I looked, and behold, a door standing open in heaven. The first voice which I heard, like the sound of the trumpet, speaking to me, 'Come up here. I want to show you what must take place after these things, after the church.' He said, immediately I was in the spirit, and behold, a throne was standing in heaven, and one sitting on the throne. And he who was sitting on the throne was like a jasper stone and sardis in appearance. And he says, and there was a rainbow around the throne, an emerald in appearance, lights everywhere, all of this light. He said, around the throne were 24 thrones, and upon the thrones I saw 24 elders. He said, sitting, clothed in white garments, golden crowns on their heads." Now, Dr. Walvoord, and I kind of agree with this, says that 24 elders here are representative of the church. Remember, the elders are the elders, the presbyteros, or the bishopros, the word elder, and they're the leaders of the church. They're just representing the church. I think it's a picture for all of us. Not just 24 guys. I think it's for all of us. And he says, from the throne proceed flashes of lightning and sounds and peals of thunder. So you can imagine what this scene's like. And then we get down to verse 9. And he says, "And when the living creatures give glory and honor," remember they're flying perpetually in the air, "holy, holy, holy is the Lord God Almighty." I couldn't imagine the scene. Myriads and myriads of people, millions of souls, all worshiping here. This has got to be some scene. And then he says, "And when the living creatures give glory and honor and thanks to him who sits on the throne, to him who lives forever, the 24 elders will fall down before him who sits on the throne and will worship him who lives forever and ever and will cast their crowns before the throne." Sorry, Jack. You see, I mean, the whole idea is, why wouldn't it be that way? You see, who enabled me to do whatever I did with, you see, would be the Lord. Where did the right motivation come from? Did it come from my flesh or did it come from the Spirit of God? It comes from the Spirit of God. You see, he's all in all. He gets all the glory. He's the only celebrity. And the whole idea is we cast them at his feet. You see, the whole idea of the reward is it just comes to him. There is a judgment seat. We will stand before it. You see, our motives for what we've done, all the good things, and by the way, it's going to be a lot different than you might think it is. You might think it is, oh man, I shouldn't have skipped going to the mission last week. You know, that's not what he cares about. He wants to know that if you only got 4 hours sleep, how did you treat your wife in the first 15 minutes? Uh-oh. Right? See, he sees everything. Whatever you do, do all to the glory of God. So, man, it's just more than, oh, you know, I have an attendance pin. See how many Sundays I endured? You know, that should mean something. No, it doesn't. He doesn't do that. It's just your life. You see, and ultimately, in the end of it all he's trying to say is that he's concerned about how we live. And the primary motive of my life, and I hope the primary motive of your life, though the Lord said it this way, I've heard other men say it, but all that ultimately will matter in my life, ultimately, is if I hear him say, well done, good and faithful servant. That's all you want to hear. That matters forever, you see. And so that becomes a motivation to our lives. I don't want it to be a scary one. I don't want to think, man, I'm going to be ashamed of myself. I don't believe that's going to be part of that at all. You see, it's just a matter that if I am poorly motivated, what it tells me is, and I do things grudgingly, or I do have to be seen by men, I think that the clear marker of what that means in my life is this. I don't nearly love Christ enough. And that's my problem. You see, I don't love him. And my view is, and if you don't love him, I can tell you why. You don't know him. Now, you may know he died for you, but when you know him, he is the ultimate. To know him is to love him. You see, it changes, and your life changes. So that's what will be going on before the wedding feast of the Lamb. Next week, we get into the tribulation. Let's close in prayer. Father, thank you so much for our time together. I pray as we put these pieces together that this whole idea of the future, the end times, becomes in many ways just clear and easier to understand and motivational for each and every one of us. In Christ's name we pray. Amen.